This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. For episode 553... we've got something new. No, we haven't. We've got something old. We've got Tim Lynch back.
Just for a change. I'm like a bad smell around here, Sam. You can't get rid of me.
You are doing great work. We love having you back.
Very good. Well, this week I was quite fortunate. I managed to catch up with Deborah Manning, who, amongst other things, set up Kiwi Harvest and a whole other raft of initiatives that we'll go through in the conversation. But I thought we'll just, as a bit of an intro to for those who may not have heard of Deborah, because she tends to go under the radar, I'll go through some of the awards and honours that she's been given. So in 2022, Deborah was named Sustainability Superstar at the Sustainable Business Network Sustainable Business Awards. She's been named as a Distinguished Alumni of Otago Polytechnic, was one of 2023's top 50 women in food and drink in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In 2022, Kiwi Harvest jointly won the not-for-profit category at the Grand Business South Awards. She was a finalist in the Community Hero section of the Woman of Influence Awards. In 2020, a semi-finalist in the Kiwi Bank New Zealand Local Hero of the Year Awards. In 2024, she was given the King's Birthday Honours and became a New Zealand Order of Merit. And in 2025, Deborah was named the Sustainability Leader of the Year. So she's got a few credentials and is pretty busy. So we're pretty fortunate to get an hour of her time to have a chat with her.
Listening to all of those credentials, you'd wonder what she has to do with hope.
Ah, a lot. And we'll find that out.
And I am the founder of Kiwi Harvest and the New Zealand Food Network, and I work in both those businesses. I've had a couple of careers. My first career was in physiotherapy, and I worked in public hospitals, both here in New Zealand and overseas. I met my husband and we started a family, and we were living in London for a couple of years, and we came back to New Zealand and settled in Dunedin, at which point I was fortunate enough to be able to go back to university and retrain as a lawyer, which I did here at the University of Otago. And I worked in a couple of law firms in Dunedin, and I also did a bit of teaching at the pharmacy school. Medico-legal, regulatory compliance, that sort of thing. And that was all going pretty well, except I had a feeling inside of me that I didn't feel quite fulfilled. The usual drivers of success in life just weren't doing it for me. I had a beautiful family, wonderful three children, all healthy and happy and doing well. But the usual drivers of success, which I thought were, you know, how much money do you make and how high up in the organisation can you rise and who do you know that will make you feel successful? That didn't resonate with me at all. So I thought to myself, I need to find more significance in my life and not focus on trying to be successful in life. And what did that look like? And I wasn't sure what that looked like. How do you put more significance into your life? So I just kept myself open to an idea that something will come, and there's always magic in new beginnings. So I waited, and one day I was reading a newspaper and saw two articles on the same page, and one was about dumpster diving and perfectly edible food being thrown away, and the other was about food insecurity in our backyard and how children were going to school without breakfast or going to bed at night without dinner. And I just had one of those light bulb moments where I thought, what if we could intercept that food before it got anywhere near the dumpster and use it to direct it and to put it back into the community to feed these people who don't have enough to eat? And what would that look like? And I knew I wanted to set up a charity. I wasn't motivated by trying to make any money out of anything. Obviously, it needs to be a profitable, charitable business, but I thought about what that might look like. And so I did some research, found that there was one food rescue operating in New Zealand called Kibosh out of Wellington, but nothing in the South Island at all that I could see. So I set up a company and a trust and got on board trustees and directors. And I chose those initial directors really carefully because I knew that I would need certain skill sets. So they didn't come from just being great friends of mine, which a lot of charities seem to do these days. Coincidentally, some of them were good friends, but I chose them for their skill set and obviously their passion to make a difference in the community. So I knew that I would need a chef, somebody who could tell me all about food and how to manage the food safely. I knew that I would probably need a lawyer because I was going to give up my practicing certificate, and there's always lots of legal compliance that needs to be done. An accountant was really important because I think all charitable entities should have an accountant on their board that gives legitimacy to the way you receive and handle a charitable dollar. I was, as the founder, had the enormous passion and the drive for it. And the last person I needed was somebody who could open doors for me. Somebody who, if they picked up the telephone and said, I'd like you to speak to this woman, she's got this idea she'd like to pitch to you, then they would feel like they could do that because of the mana of the businessman who, and he would help me run the business as well from a business sense. So that's basically what happened. I just decided to do it, and off we went.
How does compliance look like in something like this? Like how if you're intersecting food from the waste stream, are we talking food that's post-date, or are we talking food which is still it's cosmetically damaged, or what does that look like?
So food rescues collect food that's good enough to eat but not to sell. So we try not to call it food waste because that creates this negative connotation that we're giving food waste to people to eat. So we call it surplus, unable to be sold food, but still perfectly edible. That might be for a variety of reasons that we collect it and then distribute it back into the community to charitable organisations feeding people. Now, those reasons could be short dated, so it might be coming up close to its use by date. It might be slightly past its best before date, and you'll know, Tim, the importance of understanding the difference between a use-by date and a best before date. And, you know, we can go into that if you want to, but I'm sure most of the listeners will understand the difference. So it might be that. It might be cosmetically unappealing, like wonky looking or imperfect looking. The banana might have lots of black freckles on it, and people don't want that. They want the one that's still green, whereas in fact the wonky banana, the freckled banana's got the most flavour in it, as we know. Or the apple might be blemished, or the packaging might be slightly wrong. Sometimes it's a labelling issue as well. All sorts of reasons why food comes through food rescues to be distributed back into the community.
And what did it look like? Was this like literally you've got a team of people that you've handpicked to put this together? I'm assuming you've approached supermarkets and said, look, I want to intervene in the waste stream and what's happening here. Did you like literally put the food in the back of your car and distribute it that way? What were those early days looking like?
So in those early days, I didn't have any money. So the trouble that charities have when they first set up is that you need to show success in order to apply for funding, but you can't get going to show success without some funding unless you are willing to fund it yourself. So I did everything. I wrote policy manuals and procedures, and I did feasibility studies, and I approached food businesses and tried to convince them why this was a sensible idea for their surplus food that they couldn't sell, why it would save them money so they weren't having to dump it. I got charities on board in the community so that they would receive the food and then pass it on to their clients. They needed to have the infrastructure in place. If I was going to give them cartons of milk, for example, they needed to have fridges big enough to take those pallets of milk or half pallets of milk. And so I just used my own car and I funded the operations myself. I drove my car around collecting and distributing the food. I then enlisted a friend to help me collect it when it became too much food. When there was so much bread in the back of my car I couldn't see out of the back of my car, I drove my car to a local car dealer and asked the owner to come down and have a look at my car and said, look, I've got this problem. I can't see out of the back of my car because I've got all of this food that's been given to me that I can redistribute back into the community. But the great news is you can help me solve that problem if you give me one of your vans. So so they did, you know, and that's sort of how it grew. And then as it grew and I got a bit of data behind the operations, I then applied for funding to local trusts and local foundations, etc. That first lot of funding paid for a part-time driver. That then, well, now we had the van and we had a driver, and that then freed me up to grow the business as well. And then it just grew. That the idea was really well received, and we just took off. I had food businesses. The most common reasons why the food businesses would not were reluctant to support me. They either said yes straight away, what a great idea. Usually that was the artisan producers, so the bakers that had got up at 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to create their product did not want to see that being thrown away at the end of the day. They weren't difficult to convince at all. Some of the larger ones were a bit more difficult, and one of the reasons I got I would get, we can't give you our food because customers will bring it back to us and ask for a refund if they get it for free. So I would say to them, well, surely if you had a policy in place that was no receipt, no refund, that would address that. Oh, yes, they'd say, okay. So then they would say things like, it'll cut across our customer base. If we give you food, people won't come and shop here because they'll be getting free food from you. And I would say, well, these people aren't shopping in the supermarket anyway. They can't afford to come and shop in the supermarket. And what if we gave them food? We would then free up some of their budget to actually be able to come into your supermarket and shop. This support is not an everyday 365 days of the year support. Food Rescue can't do that. It is to get people out of the system that they're in where they can't feed their families. Then they would say to me, it's against the law. No, I'm not allowed to do that. It's against the law. That was an easy one to fix because I just showed them the clause in the Food Act, the Good Samaritan clause, that said that food donors are immune from any kind of liability if they give food to a charitable organisation with the intention that the person who consumes it is not going to pay for it. So there's no exchange of money at all. And the food is safe and suitable when it leaves the control of the food premises. So that was easy to show them that and make them feel comfortable about that. And then the last one they would say to me was, oh no, well, we don't have any waste. And that was the trickier one really to get around, because that meant they either were turning a blind eye to it or they were unaware of it. So I had to gently say to them, well, why don't you do an audit, or why don't you let me speak to your the manager of the, say, the produce department, and talk to them about what is still edible and doesn't have to go into the pig bin because it's got a little bruise on it or something like that. And then you'll see what can go to humans and what must obviously go to composting or pig farming because it isn't fit for human consumption. So those were the problems in the first place that I encountered.
Did your legal background become useful in that sense?
Yes, in the sense that I could tell them that they weren't going to be liable for any if anything went wrong, because I would take control of that food. And it was certainly useful in establishing all of the structure around the organisation. But it was really about understanding their brands as well. Because just because they're not going to be liable from anybody getting sick if perhaps the cool chain wasn't maintained and things like that, although we could show them how important that was to us, that we maintain the cool chain for food to keep it safe. But it was their brand. People will remember that branded product came from that particular business and it wasn't of good quality. So I had to make sure that I really protected their brand reputation.
Yeah, I can certainly see how you would have to do that.
I think I've had enough of lawyers this week. Let's talk songs instead.
Yeah, go on. Well, last weekend was pretty dreary, and that reflected in our song choices. So I think this week maybe we'll have something a little bit more upbeat because the sun is out, and you can tell because the students, they remind me of seals when they come out of the cold water in the harbour and they sun themselves on the rock. So let's start things off with a song.
Shorts, puffer jackets and jandals.
the Dunedin sunshine, yeah. Let's go for Turnstile Blues by a band called Autolux for some scratchy shoegazing goodness.
Myself to fall in place.
Let's take a bit of a step back, Tim. You are a culinary lecturer doing your doctorate of professional practice on responses of the potential responses, the how should a culinary lecturer respond. I'm making stuff up, Tim.
Yeah, I'll just take over here. What my doctorate is about, initially what I thought the doctorate was going to be, was I thought I was going to come up with a whole lot of hard and fast rules of how we can navigate climate change, how we can work around it. And that was where I started from. What my doctorate is more and more morphing into is actually the human condition, which is climate change, because it's a distinctly human condition. And within that, the emotions, eco-anger, the anxieties, and all the whole range of emotions that this is bringing forward. And we're seeing a lot of these emotions playing themselves out on multiple levels. We're seeing it at a governmental level with our current government's viewpoints on things like climate change and eco-stability versus the previous government under the Ardern administration on their viewpoints on exactly the same subject. So where it's becoming more and more about is climate change, food resilience, and food wastage are all intertwined, and they become more and more part of this notion of like societal inequality or structural inequality, and the two or the three all feed into each other. And so the conversation with Deborah was morphing more and more into that area about what is this notion of sort of structural inequality within societies, and how do we try and mitigate some of this, and how is her work part of the process of mitigation of that? Do you think that, you know, if we think of like structural inequity within society, and excuse me if this is kind of getting a little bit heavy, but what do you think the role of food is within that structural inequity? I mean, because obviously, you know, you're on the front line. You're facing people who are at the bottom of the cliff when it comes to stuff like this.
Yeah.
What were your insights surrounding that sort of structural inequity, particularly with food?
If we start by talking about food waste, I think food waste is one of the most overlooked drivers of both climate change and social inequity. And I think they go together. So when we waste food, we're not just throwing away something that's edible, we're wasting all of the resources that went into producing that. So, you know, the water, the labour, the energy, you know, that sort of thing. And we know that food waste accounts for about 10% of greenhouse gas emissions, and that's a staggering figure. But there's also this moral issue, the fact that we waste so much food while so many people can't access it is a symptom of, I think, a broken system. I think it speaks to deeper inequities of access, of affordability, of power and balance, that sort of thing. And so I think if we tackle food waste, we're not just saving the planet, we're not just talking about saving the planet, we're talking about creating a more just and equitable food system. And when we rescue food and redistribute it to communities in need, we're not just reducing the emissions, but we're working towards restoring dignity and easing the burden of families, helping shift a culture of one of excess to one of responsibility. So I think food waste and food support sit at the intersection of say environmental and social justice, and if we work on both, then we hopefully will start to shift the dial on both.
For sure, I agree with everything you said there. I also wonder, do you think there's a like kind of uniquely New Zealand context to this as well?
Look, I think it happens. It's happening all over the world. Obviously, there are inequities happening in countries all over the world. But I think what makes it even more poignant in New Zealand is our cultural identity. You know, values like caring for others and guardianship of the environment are woven into the fabric of who we are. And so, you know, when we're wasting food, we're not living up to those values. But if we see food rescue as a way to reconnect to those threads, to restore the balance, those inequities, then we're honouring the people and we're protecting the land and the whenua, and we're showing that a more circular and compassionate system is possible. So these aren't separate problems, food waste and food insecurity. They're deeply entangled. And I think solving them will require us to think more holistically about them.
Yeah, that notion of social sustainability—it's embedded within many things, many factors that all kind of have to work symbiotically in a lot of ways. And do you think, you know, at the start of Kiwi Harvest, when you were driving around in your car delivering bread out the back, were you thinking about this, kind of connection of social sustainability, or were you just going, well, here's it? There's a one-dimensional problem, I think I can fix it? Or were you aware of the complex nature of it at that stage?
Not as complex as I've now come to realise it is. When I first started, it was about the urgency of the need, of just getting this food into communities to feed people in need. As I got more and more involved in it, and as you know, the years went by, I realised that there is so much more to it than just giving somebody something to eat. You know, I think, you know, you talk about social sustainability. Well, I think that's about creating systems that support people to not just survive, but to thrive, you know, to live with dignity, connection, and opportunity, hope, as you say. And so at Kiwi Harvest, we don't just see food as a commodity. We see it as a human right and a powerful connector. The way food is grown and shared and valued reflects the kind of society that we are. And rescuing food is the first step. But what matters just as much is how we then redistribute it. We need to redistribute it with care and respect and in ways that empower communities. That's why we work through local organisations who are providing food support for people in their communities, because they know their community members. They know their needs. We just deliver the food to them and let them do what they do best, providing the wraparound services so that they can transition people into and out of the food support system. So I think social sustainability is not, we shouldn't look at addressing food insecurity as an act of charity. But it's a matter of equity and justice. It's about creating systems that are inclusive and resilient and rooted in compassion. When we treat surplus food, in our instance, as a resource for strengthening and building up communities and not just reducing waste, I think we're helping build a more socially sustainable Aotearoa. That's the bigger picture.
It's an astonishingly powerful tool, food, isn't it? Especially when you start looking at it in the mechanism that you use it to build communities, to maintain dignity, to be able to bring groups together in a cohesive nature. And I guess one of the other things about food, perhaps, is it doesn't have that top-down domineering approach to it. What you're talking about there is you come to people at their level. And that's where the dignity comes from. There's no sense of going to someone and saying and being punitive about the fact that they need food. You know, it's a response to circumstance or an environment. Kiwi Harvest has expanded and expanded. Do you find there's a double-edged sword for yourself? On the one hand, that you're pleased with the expansion and the ability to get to more resources and to help more people? Or on the other hand, you said that the need is there and that your business, quote unquote business, is expanding to fill that need. Do you have a tension between the two?
Wouldn't it be great if we didn't have the problems in the first place? If we could solve the food waste issue, and if we had no food insecurity, that would be wonderful. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. So there is always going to be a place for food rescues to who address the urgency of the immediate need. And then we have organisations like the New Zealand Food Network and the New Zealand Food Waste Champions, of which I'm a trustee, and Kiwi Harvest, who look at long-term systemic change that's going to be needed as well. So when I first started Kiwi Harvest, the focus was local, rescuing good food, getting it to communities in need. But as the mahi grew, so did my understanding that of the national picture that we were talking about before. I saw the enormous volumes of bulk surplus food that was sitting at a manufacturer or a producer's level, at that level. Too much for one food rescue or a community to absorb. We're talking 50, 60, 100 pallets of a product. And it wasn't being redistributed because there wasn't a national system in place to move it to where it was needed. So I championed the idea for the creation of a New Zealand food network for a couple of years to support and scale the impact of food rescue across the country. The idea was that we would have a big warehouse in the North Island and a big one in the South Island, and that food, surplus food in bulk volumes would go to these warehouses and food hubs around the country that were registered for the New Zealand Food Network support would be offered food in mixed pallet loads. Instead of 30 pallets of one product, they would be offered 5 or 6 pallets a week of a mixed pallet load. So the mixed pallet load would have cereal in it and milk powder in it and vegetables and ambient product, tin goods, and dried goods. That made it more, that made it easier for them to receive and get it out into their communities. So I asked, it was going to cost a lot of money, obviously, and I went to the government and asked them. This was in about 2019, maybe 2018, 2019, and asked them if they would fund it. So I went to MFE, Ministry for the Environment, and I said, there are hundreds of thousands of tons of food that are being dumped in our landfills because there is no infrastructure in place to receive it and distribute it around the country. And so I'm going to save you money by keeping this out of landfill. And the cleverness of the idea, like all food rescues, is that we're going to repurpose that food to feed people in the communities. So they said, that's a fantastic idea, but it sounds like you should be speaking to MSD because you're feeding people. So I'd have to go back to Wellington again and get an appointment with MSD, and I'd tell them the same story. I'm going to feed people with so many millions of meals every year from this food that was going to be thrown away. And of course, they then said to me, sounds like an MFE problem. You should go to MFE and talk to them. So I just got bounced around all the time. It's a great example of how our food system is really siloed. I tried to get private funders to get involved, but it was too much money for them as well. So unfortunately, when COVID became, the global pandemic and food, we could see what was happening in Europe and then come sweeping down the globe and coming to New Zealand. One of the private people that I had reached out to for funding came to me and said, what would it take for you to put a proposal to government to fund this, but you have to do it really fast, and how quickly could you set this up? So we got together a group of people, and over about 14 weeks we designed the system from what I had in a 10-slide PowerPoint presentation into a government business proposal for funding from Treasury. Thankfully, we got some very, very smart people, way smarter than I was, to put this piece of work together. And in 14 weeks, we set up the New Zealand Food Network with government funding. So, you know, that was one of the positive things that came out of the lockdown, when all of these food businesses closed down and the ports closed down and this food was just sitting and going to rot because there was no infrastructure in place to get it out into the communities. So that was a massive success for us. So we just started the New Zealand Food Network, and now that supplies food to, I think, 65 food hubs regularly each week around the country. And it's fully funded by government, whereas food rescues, Kiwi Harvest included, are not funded by government. There's a small amount of funding in this year's budget, but mostly not funded. And so they have to find their own charitable dollar.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm joined by Tim Lynch, who is reporting on his conversation with Deb Manning from Kiwi Food Harvest. During the pandemic, we all still got fed. Food still turned up. Our food system seemed to be robust. Is that a good description of our food system?
Our food systems are robust-ish. New Zealand as a country is remarkable. We produce enough food to feed approximately 20 million people a year. That's ballpark stuff. It's around that. If you look out at the Tauri Plains, we have incredible capacity for food production. One of the issues that we face, particularly around food waste and its relation to climate change, isn't so much in the production of it, it's in the distribution of it. So at a ballpark, about a third of all food that is produced is wasted. Which makes, you know, food waste, or the greenhouse gas produces from methane and from the food waste, is printed about the third largest emitter in the world. So you've got China currently, although China's emissions are now decreasing. So you've got China followed by the States, and then you've got food, and they're the major emitters at the moment. So the structural inequity that's trying to be sort of worked or looked into there by Deborah is, what does it look like when you reimagine in these food systems, in which case you don't have that occurring, you don't have that significant amount of waste. Now, that, you know, in design terms, that's a wicked problem because it's so multifaceted in the way that it has to be approached. So she's looking at it both simultaneously at a governmental level, she's looking at a local level, and at a regional level, all at the same time. The way I tend to view it here is through an educational lens, which makes it seem a little bit arm's length sometimes for myself, and that's a lot where my doctoral stuff comes in, because it means that I get closer to the problem.
It's kind of remarkable that you reimagined what a fully integrated food system could look like in 14 weeks. It's quite an astonishing thing. Do you think that's provoked a conversation at a governmental level about the need to start reimagining what our food distribution and production system in New Zealand looks like?
Well, you know, the answer would be, in an ideal world, yes, but in reality, there doesn't seem to be any home for a food system in government. Do you know where it sits? I mean, it intersects in so many different departments. You know, you've got agriculture, and you've got food security, and you've got waste, and you've got health and education. It doesn't seem to have its own department, which, you know, if we had a department for food or a minister for food, then maybe we could start to bring everybody closer together. But so no, I don't think it's a priority at this stage, sadly.
Yeah, it is interesting, and it does intersect within a whole lot of, it doesn't matter which governmental department you go to, at some stage it's going to intersect with food in some form or fashion. Do you think that it's like, how do you manage working A, on a governmental level, and then B, also at a grassroots level at the coalface of need? Is that a difficult thing to navigate?
Well... Not for me, because I don't work at an operational level in the business. So there is a whole business called Kiwi Harvest with its five branches around the country that operates at the grassroots community level. And then there's another separate New Zealand Food Network, and that operates at more of a national level, supporting food rescues around the country and food banks around the country as well. My job is to think about how we can manage change in the food system, and what does that look like, you know, that sort of thing. That's what I tend to focus my efforts on now.
Yeah, I remember when I was doing my master's degree, and we'd have conversations with the guys from doing the MBAs and the lecturers for the MBAs, etc. And we would talk to them about this notion of social enterprises. And they would say there is no such thing as a social enterprise. There is just enterprise. That is it. There is no social compartment to it. Have you found the same thing with what you're doing? It is, in one hand, it's a social enterprise, but the structures you have around it are very much rooted in a traditional business models.
My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, of when we talk about social enterprise in this context, we're talking about providing a goods or a service for a social purpose that you can then receive financial gain from, so that it will support your organization. Is that what you mean by social enterprise? Yeah. Okay, so we don't sell our service. We don't charge people for the work that we do. We don't buy the food and we don't sell the food. So there is no element of social enterprise in what we do. And the New Zealand Food Network is the same. We call ourselves a social venture or a for-purpose business. We try to avoid the word charity because that tends to have very old-fashioned connotations of people just in the smaller charities, not the larger ones, but the smaller ones, people doing good because they have a personal passion for it. We definitely treat Kiwi Harvest as a business. We have our own KPIs. We measure everything that we do. You know, we can confidently say in the 14 years that we've been operating, we've rescued close to 15 million kilograms of food and translated that into 35 million meal equivalents. Put back into the community. And, you know, when one in five children are going hungry, that's a significant amount of food that has gone back into a community as well.
Let's have a socially enterprising song.
All right, let's go for something nice and uplifting, shall we? So this is a song called Stonecutters by a band called Dope Lemon, who incidentally are actually playing in New Zealand in August.
Thank you.
examples that stand out in your in the time that you've been doing that, where you went, here I have at a personal level for this particular person in their life, I've made a direct impact. Have you ever had moments like that?
In the early days when I was driving, we get stories all the time. Every week we get stories from grateful and heartwarming stories from the organisations that we support through their clients that have told them about the value of the food that we give them. But in the early days here in Dunedin, when I was driving around and collecting and distributing the food myself, one story that I that sort of stays with me is about a group of women and children who were staying at our local women's refuge in the Safe House. Now, these women and children had fled situations of violence and sort of uncertainty in their lives. For them, every day was about finding safety and rebuilding their lives. They were incredibly vulnerable. When I went through Kiwi Harvest, was able to provide fresh, nutritious food to the refuge for the women to cook, it made a huge difference. And it wasn't just about feeding people. It was about offering a sense of normalcy for these women and care in a very difficult time. And they told me that being able to prepare and share meals together, simply prepare and share meals together, brought comfort and a sense of empowerment and a feeling of home for them when they were so dislocated from their normal life. And they would share things like the meals made them feel stronger and able to start thinking that there will be a future together for them again and their families. So I think, you know, that really showed me that food became a symbol of hope and healing and not just survival. And, you know, that's the power of food, isn't it?
It is. It's an astonishing story. And that is the power of food. It creates a time, a moment. It's a sharing. It's a whole lot of things that's really easy to take for granted, very easily to take for granted. I mean, the work that you do is emotional as it is practical. Between sort of stories like you've just told then and effectively dealing at governmental levels and on a strategic level, that's all pretty draining. How do you keep yourself going? How do you not get overwhelmed by the enormity of what you're dealing with?
True. This work can be very emotionally heavy. You're constantly confronted with people's hardship and systemic barriers and the scale of what needs to change. At times it can feel, and it does feel, very overwhelming. I think what keeps me going is remembering why I started this journey in the first place, and it was because of the people and the communities and the hope. But I also rely on an incredible team of people. I've got a wonderful staff, great CEOs, and they've got their teams as well around the country, volunteers that help us, and our partners, our food partners and our business partners, our sponsor corporate partners who share the same passion and commitment for what we do. We support each other and we celebrate our successes, and we also share those hard moments. And I guess it's probably also about trying to find balance out of work with my family and my friends. I mean, this work, as with most charitable entities, is definitely a marathon, not a sprint.
I mean, obviously, your days are pretty packed at the moment. I'm trying to find sort of an hour of your week to have this conversation was difficult enough. What do you think a day in the life of Deborah Manning in 10 years' time will look like?
Gosh, in 10 years' time. Well, ideally, it would look, and hopefully, it would look different to it does now. I'd be less hands-on because the system would be working well. There'd be strong connections between communities and farmers, and businesses, and organisations, with everybody playing their part in a way. In 10 years' time, ideally, I'd be out of a job because the network of people and systems would be so effective. And I'd be feeling proud that our efforts have created or helped to create a future where no one goes hungry and waste is a thing of the past.
I think that's a fantastic note to leave it on. Deborah, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with me. That was exceptionally interesting stuff. I am just astounded by the amount of energy that you're able to put into this. Like at Polytech here, we have a pretty good relationship with Kiwi Harvest, with our students, and how we use and repurpose some of your products. And I think that the wider holistic view of food and the role that it plays in society is quite refreshing for my for me to hear that from somebody else, because I spend a lot of time talking about it myself.
Yes, it's. Yeah, I mean, you've used the word a couple of times. The words a couple of times. Food is a powerful connector, and it absolutely is. And I think when we work towards a future where we are using food to connect people and communities and producers, then I'm hopeful for that future.
She talked about hope, Tim.
She did talk about hope, which is remarkable, because if you think someone in her position who is dealing with, you know, structural inequality, she's dealing with governmental policy, she's dealing with like grassroots face-to-face poverty, the notion of hope in here is the flip side of despair, because if someone like Deborah isn't hopeful, it'll just be despair, and from there'll be nothing. So there is hope, there's hope everywhere, there's hope in the way that it manifests itself, and I think also in here, and this comes back to very much what I'm writing about at the moment, is using hope as a navigation tool for when you're in these murky, ambiguous areas such as this. It's easy to be overwhelmed by things, but hope is the compass by which you can get out. But the thing about hope is a compass, it's not a cure. It won't fix the problem, it won't make it go away. And that's where you get this notion of toxic hope coming in, is that it is vacuous and empty, and it doesn't actually facilitate any change. And what you're seeing here with the way Deb and Kiwi Harvest operate is you're seeing how hope can be used as a navigation tool for change and for positivity.
And who are we going out to today?
So we are going to go out to a song called Heavenly by the very hopefully named band called Cigarettes After Sex.
Listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world, brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every weekday afternoon at 3. No, we're not. We're broadcast every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. I've been talking with Tim Lynch, who brought his conversation with Deb Manning from Kiwi Harvest. I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mati wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.